Hello and welcome to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 in Toronto and CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines. I'm your host, Daniel Angernon. On today's show, we will be speaking with Dr. Kendra Coulter, professor at Brock University in the Labor Studies Department, as well as Social Justice and Equity Studies. And she has a book coming out called Revolutionizing Retail, which you can follow on her blog on retail workers' rights at revolutionizingretail.org. And the reason she's on the show today is because this September, she started teaching what is most likely, if I'm not mistaken, the first ever non-human animal focused labor studies course at a major university. I'm really excited to learn more about it, and it should make for a really interesting interview. So welcome to the show, Kendra Coulter.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here. You're definitely doing important work, and I have a lot of respect for Lauren Corman, who I know has been very involved with the show for many years.
Absolutely, and so we really appreciate having you on the show. So let's start with bringing this course to Brock University. What inspired you to create this course?
Well, I joined the Center for Labor Studies at Brock University in July of 2012. And almost immediately started expressing interest in the intersections of animals and labor. It was an area I was beginning to research and thought it might be something that would really interest students and that would complement the courses that already exist at Brock. So at Brock, we are fortunate to have the best concentration of animal studies scholars in Canada, which is quite exciting. And in some of the courses, you know, work or class dimensions will be explored, but none yet are centering on the labor questions, both at our university and, as far as we know, anywhere. So, it's, yeah. You know, there may be different labor dimensions integrated into different animal studies courses, but nothing has really privileged the labor questions and sort of put at the forefront or foreground in those dimensions. But given the importance of the economy, given the centrality of work to everyone's life, whether the work is paid or unpaid, we thought this could be a really interesting course to sort of bolster the research that I'm doing, but also propel this area of inquiry. So as something for students to think about and something for researchers to think about. And it's been going really well. We're wrapping up next week. And so far, it's been a very interesting experience. And we're offering it again in the spring.
That's fantastic to hear. That's really cool that you talk about that labor aspect, because I came to Brock University to take the Critical Animal Studies program, so I've seen that sort of centering in the sociology department, but it's cool to see it like really expanding. And so to start off, what do students learn about in your class? What are some of the overarching themes that if someone wanted to take that course again in the spring, what might they expect?
Because it's such a broad topic and area, and there are so many different things we could explore, it was very challenging to try to narrow down what are the most important dimensions we need to explore. And so I thought about it in relation to other labor studies courses, as well as in relation to the different courses that are already being taught at Brock. So in sociology, in English, in visual arts, yeah, in political science, and decided that we would organize a lot of our work around this idea of animal work, which has two core dimensions. So the first is the work done with animals. The second is the work done by animals. So we analyze and understand what that means to have these two different, distinct but very overlapping dimensions of animal work. Next, we begin to critically analyze how animals are linked to capitalism and to class relations, because there's both material dimensions in terms of work and pay and lives and who's living and who's dying, but there's also a lot of symbolic and cultural dimensions in terms of how animals are used as symbols, are employed as metaphors. So that's the sort of our centerpiece. And then in the final third of the course, which arguably is the most important, is we grapple with strategies for improving human and animal well-being. Mm-hmm. So looking at some more expected organizations like unions, but also looking at the work of advocacy. So whether it's paid or unpaid, being done in the private sector or in the public sector, a lot of people are working on behalf of and sometimes with animals to better their lives. And the third dimension is animals in the state or public policy in terms of what role can laws and governments play in Canada and around the world to improve animals' well-being and human workers' well-being. And so one of the challenging questions is whether we can link the well-being of human workers and animal workers, because we could certainly look at examples of improving animals' well-being, but does it also benefit humans? And of course, the opposite is true. An organization might be really advocating for the humans, but what is being done in terms of the animals? And so we look at where there can be shared exploitation. Sometimes there's different ways that humans and animals are who are working side by side are being treated. And one of the most exciting dimensions, I think, is grappling with the potential for what I call interspecies solidarity. The solidarity is a beautiful concept, very central to labor and social justice. And, you know, it's the idea of moving beyond sympathy. So sympathy can certainly have a role, and there are many animals who deserve our sympathy, but could we also foster empathy? Could we also foster a sense of shared struggle? And what might that look like? So how does that challenge our understandings of solidarity, and how could it actually be implemented on the ground?
I really like that you brought that up. The idea of solidarity, I think that's a term that's very often used in the animal rights or advocacy movements, but how would you define it in terms of labor relations, in terms of labor solidarity?
It's always going to be context specific, and context really matters in terms of understanding the particulars, because particular work relationships are going to force people to do certain things, to understand themselves and animals in particular ways. So, you know, even just taking the act of killing an animal for food, if you're doing that in a small rural context where you've known the animal for his or her whole life and you kill them after many long years and very infrequently, that's a very different relationship you have rather than being on the industrialized assembly line slaughterhouses. Mm-hmm. Right? So the human worker is going to be shaped by his or her work situation. And, you know, I mean, it's interesting, the idea of solidarity is very popular in places like Latin America and in certain poorer communities, but in mainstream Canadian culture or North American culture, it's not often talked about outside of perhaps the labor movement.
Yeah, there's definitely that disconnect there. So going back to when we went through a little walkthrough of your course, you talked about the two kinds of animal work, the work done with animals and work done by animals. Let's start with the first part. What are the human labor issues in animal-centered industries?
You know, something like horse racing, which is very central to Niagara, to, you know, southwestern Ontario, arguably even bigger around the world and expanding into countries like China. There we have sort of a real kind of capitalist pyramid often, where you have, in many cases, a very wealthy capitalist owner who employs a trainer to train the horses and manage the stable. Underneath that trainer, you'll have very, very low-paid and precarious grooms and hot walkers who make very, very low wages, but are often drawn to the work because they love horses and they want to work with the horses. And so their labor is not well understood. It may be seen as unskilled by some. It may be really devalued. But in fact, they are the people who are interacting with the horses on a daily basis and required to engage in, you know, what we would call care work, which can overlap with communication work, which is understanding the horse and what is the horse feeling, what does the horse want or need. It certainly involves dirty work, which is a term we use to describe either tasks that are undesirable or work that is somewhat socially stigmatized. And they do a great deal of body work, which is the sense of working on bodies, those of others or those of yourself. So in a context like horse racing, you have jockeys who are going through immense forms of body work to try to maintain the weight necessary for racing. Grooms are doing similar things, but in general to the bodies of the horses, to try to manage pain or prevent pain or those sorts of things. And so it's a very interesting and complex context because the horses and the lowest paid workers have very intense lives for a short period of time, and then what happens to them afterwards really varies. So some horses will go and have sort of a second career working for perhaps the Mennonites, pulling their carts. Others may go on to second careers as pleasure horses or show jumping horses. Some end up slaughtered. So they have a very diverse post-career, as it were. And the same can be true for people, where they have very long hours, very intense working conditions. And, you know, even someone like Eddie Sweat, who was someone we studied in the course, who was the groom for Secretariat, one of the most famous and heralded racehorses of all time, Eddie Sweat died in poverty, despite having worked for such incredible horses for so long and arguably being this immensely skilled, valuable worker. So there's complex intersections in terms of labor relations, and that's just looking at one industry. Of course, it's going to vary if you're a veterinary technician, if you work for the Ontario Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, if you work for a humane society, if your job is to take horses to weddings and do a horse and carriage service, or in, you know, a lot of South Asian weddings, they have something called barat, which is the groom's processional, and there's often a horse used to do that. So, so even just sort of following the horse worker, thinking of the horse as the worker, within something like Southern Ontario, you see so many different forms of labor being performed.
That kind of segues perfectly into the next question, which is, of course, asking about the animals who are laborers themselves. And I think horses are definitely sort of the epitome of that, right? I mean, horses and humans have sort of co-evolved and worked together for so many years. But I'm just very interested to know, what are some of the industries where horses are laborers? Because I think a lot of people might not be as aware that it still goes on today. So if you have any... What are some examples and stuff?
Yeah, and I think when people think of horses as workers, they may picture a different time, or they may picture perhaps an underdeveloped country where there's a more direct interface of, you know, a poor person working alongside a, you know, a working horse. But there is a difference between doing work and being perceived as a worker. And that's very true in the cases of animals. And so even just taking that act of pulling a cart or pulling a carriage, if the horse is doing that in a Mennonite community or in a rural poor community where the horse is pulling, you know, hay or people or materials of some kind, that horse may be more likely to be seen as a worker or potentially even working class. That's going to depend a little bit on how people conceptualize class. But it's clearly not the act of pulling that makes the horse the worker, because the example that I like to use is that when the Duchess and the Prince were married recently, they were pulled around by horses as well. But no one's automatically thinking of those horses as workers, and certainly not of thinking them as working class. So it's very interesting to see how animals and horses become infused not only with our ideas about work, but our ideas about class. And so people are much more likely to think of a horse that we would say is quote-unquote classed more as a worker, as doing work, whereas people would be really debating whether is a show-jumping horse, is a horse-racing horse, are they working? And equine researchers will really vary. Some will reject that idea and really frame them as athletes. But we, of course, are very comfortable with human athletes being thought of as workers. And other equestrian or equine researchers will very much recognize that the horse is working. Even if it's leisure for you, it may be work for the horse.
Mm-hmm. Like, would you say animals are part of the working class? And how is that realized in our industries?
Some animals are, but because of the diversity of the intersections, you can't say that all animals are part of the working class, because many are both materially and symbolically enmeshed with more of an upper class status. They're very pampered, they're very privileged, they're used as an extension, sort of an upper class or capitalist class person's identity. Now, many animals are arguably very interwoven and interconnected with working classness in the sense of laboring, although usually for food, not for a wage, in the case of horses, and very much having to provide your work to somebody else. But there's so many different ways that even working horses or riding horses are understood by people. It's very hard to generalize. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that interspecies solidarity is impossible. I don't know that we have to work alongside animals or see animals as working class to foster a sense of solidarity. For me, solidarity is about recognizing struggle, is about recognizing exploitation, and that as long as we approach these issues thoughtfully and recognize that many people who are in positions of having to exploit animals as part of their job are themselves exploited, and that consequently this forces us to start questioning other kinds of hierarchies and how humans and animals can be used and sometimes abused in similar ways, and what possibilities exist not just for jobs with animals, but for good jobs with animals and what that might mean. Right? We've seen a large movement promoting green-collar jobs, for example, right? Because historically, it's been argued that you can have the environment being protected or you can have jobs. And over, you know, the recent years and decades, many researchers and activists have proven that that's not correct, that we do not need to choose between one or the other. And there's been promotion of green-collar jobs or good green jobs. As of yet, someone like Jason Hribal, an independent scholar in the States, has argued that animals are part of the working class, but it's very underdeveloped. We not only don't know very much about animal work, but we haven't begun to theorize what good, humane jobs might look like, and whether we can not simply critique those jobs which are problematic, but instead be promoting jobs which do good for people and do good for animals. And this is one of the things I'm grappling with as a researcher.
Well, and I'm really glad you brought that up, because I think one of the sort of points of contention between, I think, animal rights activists and those who say that animals are workers, right? There's this sort of idea that any work that a non-human animal does would be forced work, because you can't literally ask for their consent. Even if it's a really fantastic job, like a seeing eye dog or something, you don't necessarily know that that dog wants to be there. But on the flip side, there's a lot of jobs that are very positive for animals. And I was just curious, where would you draw the line, for example? How do we know what is forced work and what is not forced work?
It's hard to generalize, and I think that we need to be open to nuance and to different particulars. And, you know, you mentioned seeing eye dogs, and we've had two guest speakers, two and four-legged, come into the class, and one of whom was a police dog, and the other was Farley, who works with Therapy Tales here in the Niagara region. And it is very hard to argue that Farley hates his job. Mm-hmm. Farley's this big English sheepdog who meets with kids, and they make connections between bullying of humans and animals, telling his story. And so he is very, it is very difficult to argue that he is unhappy. In fact, he seems extremely joyful and delighted. Mm-hmm. And so there can be differences among species. Within species, there can be differences as well. You know, biological dimensions could be causing pain, or personalities. Animals are unique individuals just like humans. And so some are very interested in doing particular kinds of things. Others are not. Yet others will say, I don't feel like doing this today, but maybe tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, to use horses as an example, there's a lot of arguments that some of the great famous successful show jumpers, you know, one of whom was named Hickstead and from here in Canada, his rider and those around him argued adamantly that he knew what he was doing, that he was quite conscious, he was quite aware of what the tasks were, and that he expressed a great deal of agency in terms of awareness of the competition and awareness of shaping the relationship that he had with his rider, Eric Lamaze. And so I think that it's important to identify situations of exploitation and slavery and enslavement, but also for well-intentioned people not to inadvertently deny animals their own agency and recognize that in a work relationship, perhaps the animal did not choose to be there in the first place, but is very much shaping the nature of that. And again, an extension of that is recognizing that if we need jobs, right, and we can critique the problematic jobs, but simply critiquing them is going to exacerbate divisions between people. It's going to exacerbate tensions and the disconnect between groups of progressive people who might be able to find common ground. And so I think it's important to approach these issues thoughtfully and recognize that if we're going to try to move things away from problematic work towards better work, that this needs to be done in a thoughtful way. But we also need to talk to people who are engaged in the work themselves. And I mean, I know Lauren Corman has talked to some slaughterhouse workers, for example, who say, you know, I'm poor and this is the only option that I have and I wish I had something better. Mm-hmm. And that's a common story that we hear. So there's a way to approach this that's nuanced and thoughtful. And sometimes it requires us to suspend our expectations and our assumptions about people and try to bridge ground that, you know, perhaps animals are going to be used in work situations. And so let's work with people who work with animals themselves to try to foster mutually beneficial relationships.
Yeah, and just going back to what you were saying about agency, I think it's really interesting perspective that I read in one of your articles, but I also want to, of course, discuss it with you here. You know, not painting all animal workers with the same brush as victims. And I think there's an important argument about removing that victim label. You take something like a cow that's on a ranch, and we sort of make this assumption that, or, you know, in a slaughterhouse, they're not happy. And with Therapy Tales, that, you know, I mean, a dog playing with kids, I mean, I think we can justifiably assume that it's going to be a pretty mm-hmm. happy dog. So how can animal work be empowering and not have sort of this domination and victim relationship?
I think the first thing to do is to understand what forms of animal work exist and how they're experienced both by the humans and by the animals. And as I approach my research, I'm very much trying to do what we would call multi-species anthropology, which is to move beyond the anthropocentric or human-centric lens to recognize that there are multiple social actors of different species in a context, and there are going to be similarities and differences among them. We also want to think about how good jobs are defined. So by and large, the main criteria or the essential dimensions would be decent pay, some stability, and perhaps a chance for upward mobility. I think it's important for us to use that as a base, to recognize that we do want jobs that are secure for people, that allow people to have a basic standard of living. We don't want jobs that create poverty. Right? I do a lot of work against poverty wages, and that seems an essential precursor and an essential component of this discussion. But we can also go a little bit further, which is to think about what jobs are chosen most often by people who have a lot of choice. And some people are very selfish and they're real neoliberal subjects and they simply want money and the material. But most people, I believe, want to do good, or at least want to do no harm. And so if we think about, there's great interest in teaching, there's great interest in nursing, there's great interest in social work, it's because so many of us, you know, as kids, we are socialized to share and to cooperate. And sometimes as adults, we're rewarded for doing the opposite. But many people are still drawn to this, I have to do this for so many of my waking hours. I want to feel proud. You know, if I work in marketing and I do a good job, someone makes more money. But if I work in a school or in a low-income community and I do my job well, people's lives are better. And so we do have this desire, many of us, which I think is a very good and laudable dimension of our culture, about wanting to help people and wanting to, you know, people like you are doing this unpaid labor right now in your spare time, and you'll probably continue doing this for much of your life. But even better, I bet, would be, can you do this and get paid? Can you do good every day and sustain yourself? And so the dimension for us to begin to think about is to say, what jobs are about doing good for animals and people? So for example, if you have a group of unionized workers who are in inspection and enforcement of animal cruelty laws, their working conditions will directly impact how animals are doing. You know, if there are more of them, if they have more hours, if they are well-resourced, they will better be able to investigate and prosecute cruelty cases, right? So that is an example, maybe the most simple example of recognizing that, although that may be emotionally trying for them in the short term, when you identify a situation of abuse or neglect, undoubtedly, it's very difficult for the person who finds it, whether it's kids or animals or women or whatever it is, but that those are the sorts of people who are very proud of their work and who recognize that at the end of the day, if they've done a good job, they prevented harm. They've moved animals from a negative situation into a positive situation. So that, I think, gets us thinking about the sorts of jobs which could be positive. And an extension of that is, okay, once we begin to identify the sorts of jobs and work that could be good for people and good for animals, how do we begin to promote it? Does it require public funding? If so, we need to have a larger conversation about what kind of governments are being elected, what sorts of programs are being funded, and really build from there.
We've been talking a lot about sort of the general structure of how animals fit within a labor studies perspective. I was hoping we can sort of branch out a little more into like some of the more specifics. You know, animal rights activists working to dismantle a particular industry, say a slaughterhouse. What labor perspectives need to be taken in mind? Because we were talking a lot about, say, an equestrian, the way the grooms are treated and the way the owners are treated is much different. So I was just wondering, what is the labor perspective for something like that? Are we looking for replacement or what?
It's going to depend, and I would, you know, encourage dialogue when that can be possible. I think it is hard to foster collaboration when you approach someone saying, I want to take your job away, and that's your starting point. It may be more effective if you have a problem with a particular practice to at least reach out and try to understand the perspective of the human workers, because we so often find people feel themselves that they're trapped in these same industries, whether it's slaughtering or testing or, you know, whatever it is, that they're unhappy with their work as well. And they would very much like to either improve it in the short term or arguably get away from it. Mm-hmm. And so if the initial contact or dialogue is approached thoughtfully with sort of suspended assumptions and not a lot of preachy aggression, then perhaps there could be some interesting solidarity fostered between the humans, those who want to end the practice or at least change it, and those who are involved. And, you know, we have seen this in the environmental context, where we have seen red-green or blue-green alliances be formed when people tried to move past some of their discomfort and tried to be open and understanding to the material conditions of the people who are involved. I also think one of the most important things that people interested in animals' well-being, and as the big umbrella under whatever label you might fall, should actually really take the economy and work seriously. It's very easy to condemn those industries which are problematic, whereas taking some labor studies courses, doing some reading in progressive economics, and grappling with some of the other big leftist approaches to social justice will help with this project, which I think is essential, which is that if we're talking about changing the economy, it's not just about ending, it's about moving towards. And so we need to have proactive solutions and alternatives to propose. So, you know, understanding the specifics of the issue are essential. There may be a very clear alternative that could be created. Some of them are going to be a little bit more complex and a little bit more challenging. But again, I think that just underscores the importance of promoting proactively good green jobs or good humane jobs as an alternative, and that there is a real need for a labor perspective or multiple labor perspectives to be employed within sort of animal communities.
Really well put. One of the things you briefly touched on earlier was veterinarians and vet techs. Could you talk about the industry from a labor perspective?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting. It is healthcare for animals, but by and large, it's private healthcare for animals. And so it's very expensive. And there's some interesting shifting dynamics within veterinary practice, whereas 50 years ago you would have had perhaps a handful of women vets. Today we're seeing 95% of the Ontario Veterinary College veterinary students are women. Mm-hmm. So there's been a bit of a gender shift in terms of veterinary profession itself. How that plays out is to be determined, you know, whether those women bring with them particular goals for themselves as workers and or for veterinary practice, seek to change things or seek to maintain things is still to be determined. We're in the early stages of what we would call the feminization of veterinary practice. Veterinary technician work has been feminized for quite some time, and those would be more like nurses. And it's seen as quite a desirable job by many young women in particular who love animals, although they're not going to be compensated particularly well in terms of their paychecks. So that industry has something of a comparable hierarchy to human healthcare, other than the fact that it is fee-for-service. So some veterinarians are very driven by the financial dimensions of that work. And because they're working with for-profit research and pharmaceutical companies, that complicates some of the politics and the dynamics of their work in a similar way to doctors, even within a public system like ours, who are on a daily basis dealing with for-profit pharmaceutical companies. And there's interesting dimensions and developments in veterinary practice where we're seeing more veterinarians looking to do work, some work for free. And often in labor studies, we argue against unpaid internships and argue that people shouldn't be working for free. But in certain cases, when people are making a great deal of income, I think we could be more open to seeing that as a laudable thing to do. For example, I know there's an organization in Hamilton which specifically provides healthcare to animals of the poor. And so it's an anti-poverty organization that is seeking to not judge or blame poor people for wanting to have animals and wanting to have the joy or the love or the friendship or whatever it is that that animal provides them, but recognizing that in the current veterinary model that the costs are going to be quite high. Mm-hmm. And there are organizations that work internationally. There's one called The Brook, based out of the UK, which does a lot of fundraising. So it's an organization reliant on donations and all the volatility that encompasses, but that they specifically target working horses, donkeys, and mules. So they use that term working, and they'll engage in poor communities around the world involving the people who work alongside these donkeys and these horses, these mules, in promoting better animal welfare, in teaching them about basic veterinary practice, in providing equipment and resources that are affordable in that community in order to try to help both the animal's life and the person's life, recognizing that that work that donkey is doing is making the difference between no income and low income for the people. So, you know, and there's a group of veterinarians, and I believe doctors and veterinarians from London, Ontario, who are going into Central Africa to try to provide care for gorillas and the people who live around gorillas. So there's some interesting dimensions. And, you know, talking about the cost of veterinary care and the cost of euthanasia for people who can no longer afford an animal, the cost of euthanizing a horse and how that relates to horse slaughter is a much broader conversation. But there are other things that we can think about in terms of if animals are going to be part of the social, which undoubtedly they are, in my view, what are our responsibilities to them? And so that's going to involve lawmakers. It's going to involve medical practitioners. And, you know, I have heard arguments for there being a program of universal health care for animals. I have seen examples in countries like Cuba where veterinary care is virtually free. So the vets in Cuba are provided a salary from the government. And so the costs to people to use veterinary care are essentially non-existent. But, you know, Cuba has a very diverse way of understanding animals. But it is an interesting approach, an interesting policy to recognize, you know, could there be or should there be public veterinary care? We're in class tonight going to be talking about the city of Athens in Greece, where they have a program for dogs who are essentially considered citizens of the country. And so the municipality itself uses public money, so uses tax dollars, to sterilize dogs, to treat them, and provides them with a collar that says, you know, if this animal is in harm or causing harm, call this number, and the number is the city. And then the animals are released. So if you walk around Athens, you see dogs everywhere, which is atypical and challenges our idea that, oh, dogs are best in human homes. In the Greek context, it's a little bit different, where the people have said the dogs have a right to be here and to live on the streets and to live free as well. And we're comfortable with public money being spent to care for them. And so these prompt us to have some interesting reflection and conversations about what that means if we're going to not only work with animals, but we have animals in the social. And so our ideas about greater social justice need to include the animals.
That's a really cool perspective, and I want to come back to that in just a second. It reminds me a lot of we interviewed Will Kimlicka with Zoopolis. Talking about animals as citizens, or at least denizens, I think is a really important aspect to sort of start seeing them as beings with interests, you know? Sort of the idea that they don't belong anywhere, and sort of like, yes, they're citizens of this city or this country just as much as anyone else. But one thing I wanted to talk about was going back to the vet thing. I find it interesting, we talk about sort of the feminization of certain jobs and the subsequent devaluation of those jobs. Is there sort of a connection between those who work with animals, so those in that form of labor? So we talked about vets, we talked about people rescuing animals from places of cruelty. Is there a grand devaluation centered around the fact that these are jobs about animals?
Yes and no. It depends. And not necessarily in predictable ways either, where we may think hierarchy means humans will be above animals. And on the ground, in the realities of lots of animal work spaces, it's quite different. So to return to that example of Eddie Sweat, the black groom who worked with Secretariat, the racehorse, for a long time, Secretariat went on to a lovely retirement, and he went to stud, and he had quite a good end of life, whereas Eddie kept working and died in poverty. So this is an instance where the animal, because the animal was deemed successful and accomplished, was given great conditions, whereas the human worker was not. In other instances, it's going to vary, where there is going to be more of a predictable hierarchy, where the humans may or may not see the animals as co-workers. They may see the animals as something that they can exploit or overpower or dominate. So it's going to really vary. In general, there's a hierarchy in working with animals itself, where some of the positions are going to be given greater status and greater value, while others will be given lower status, lower value. Pay often reflects the value given to a job, although not necessarily. I mean, in our culture,
and we purport to really care about children, but the women who work as early childhood educators and in childcare centers are paid very low wages. So we have some inconsistencies in our culture more broadly.
And it reminds me of what you were saying before about people who want to do good, people who want to do jobs that help people in the world, but they're generally sort of the lesser paid jobs, you know? So sort of the idea of care work being devalued as well, is that sort of
absolutely, it's true, yes. And most of the care work positions, which involve animals, are themselves quite low paid or completely unpaid, often entirely dependent on volunteers, which affords you a greater degree of autonomy. But at the same time, most people are not financially well off enough to be able to dedicate their entire lives to the things that they love. Yeah. So there's value and importance in doing things because you're passionate about them. But we also recognize that you cannot sustain animal lives and you cannot sustain economies and societies based on volunteers.
Exactly. One of your main focuses is horses and horse-related sporting events. I've heard that a lot of the class has focused on that, which is really interesting because I don't think it's something that's really talked about too often because there is sort of a class issue at play. And I was just curious to start off for our listeners that maybe are not familiar with equestrian events. What are some of these events? Who are the workers and how are they exploited?
So of the equestrian working context or sporting context, and they are indeed called a sport and an industry simultaneously, recognizing that for some they are leisure and for others they are work. There is racing. Most of my work to date has focused on show jumping. And it's, you know, the act of competing with horses over jumps. You know, it's a global sport and a place of work for many people. And the interesting thing about horses and horse riding, and especially horse jumping, is this perception that it's of the rich, or it's for the even the aristocracy, above and beyond the capitalist class, that it's for royals. And this is incomplete. It's also quite flawed. And I think it does a disservice to the many working class and even poor people who are involved, and it certainly does a disservice to horses, who are blanketed in the politics of class in much more complicated ways. So regardless of how elite the sport is, there are always going to be manual laborers of some kind who at least some of their work will involve dirty work of literally cleaning up manure. So the spaces are always infused with labor hierarchies and class hierarchies themselves. At the same time, there are people of all kinds who engage. It's not only the Olympics. It's not only the rich. There are deeply class dimensions of elite show jumping where it is literally the 1%. It is literally the capitalist class. So the daughters often of the wealthiest and most powerful capitalist class families in Canada are involved. But on the ground, there's a much more diverse network of horse riding and even horse jumping, where some people are competing at a local fair or what we would call a schooling show when they have no illusions of grandeur. It's costing them probably a lot as a proportion of their income, but in relation to the elite A circuit or the elite show jumping spaces, it's substantially less expensive. There are some people, especially moms, who loved horses all their lives, could never afford horses, who gave up much of their adult life to doing paid and unpaid work for their families, tending to children, and that they're only able to actually ride horses later in life once they have a little bit more economic stability. So I think it's very important not to homogenize these sports as only of the rich or, you know, as only the sport of kings, as horse racing is called, but rather to see that we need to recognize that there's the production of show jumping or the production of horse racing, and that thousands or millions of human and animal bodies are involved in work in public and behind the scenes to make these things possible.
So let's talk about that production work a bit more. In terms of training, one thing that I thought was really interesting, I read this metaphor in one of your articles, was the idea of the horse as a bank account. So you deposit your training and sort of the horse is this commodity that you sort of, you put your work into and then hopefully, you know, it all works out. So just curious, how does that sort of commodification process fit throughout the entire length of the industry? Say, like, a horse from beginning to end, what might they go through that circuit?
In show jumping, it is going to be different than racing, so I can talk about show jumping to answer that question. It's a transnational capitalist industry. for show jumping, where horses are continuously being bred and bloodlines are being honed to try to build the best biological basis for show jumping. And within what we would call show jumping, there are two different kinds of competition. One is exclusively timed and based on your capabilities, who left the jumps up in the fastest amount of time. There's another group of classes that are called the hunter classes, and they extend from the old British tradition of fox hunting, where the jumps look more natural and it's judged. It's a little bit more like figure skating. And it's about how does the horse perform? How does the horse jump? How does the horse look? How do you look? And so it's there are standards, but it's much more subjective. And there can be small little ponies doing this up to, you know, quite large, you know, Grand Prix show jumpers. And so within this world of show jumping, the equine's journey is going to vary a little bit. But he or she will probably begin basic training with someone on his or her back around age 3. These are horses that are a little bit more spoiled in the sense that they're given a little more food, they're a little more protected, they're very well taken care of in terms of their aesthetics, and they may start competing age 4 or 5 and can do so until they're about 18. And so it's quite common for an effective, whether it's a pony or a horse, whether it's a hunter or a jumper, to do this work for many years. And recently I saw something that was very, very sweet, which was a girl that had shown a particular pony. She'd leased this pony for 2 years, and she had gotten too tall, so she was going to have to move on to a horse, and she wrote this beautiful thank you card to say, thank you for doing such a good job. I hope you do a good job for the next girl that gets you. And her name is Shay, and she's in London. I said I wanted to include her in my next book on animal work, and she said, I want the first copy. So, but I think that she's indicative of the fact that, you know, there are different kinds of animals and there are different kinds of people, and they can genuinely be appreciated and loved. It is a money-making context, and commodification is the exact word, where a lot of people are making their living through treating horses like real estate, where they might acquire a horse at age 5 or 8 or 12, put some work into it, and try to sell it to make more money, because that's where most of the money is made, much like quote-unquote real estate, yeah. Right, where it's your investment, or as you said, your bank account. And so everyone there would argue that they're there because they love horses. Mm-hmm. The degree to which that's expressed and how it's expressed is going to vary. You know, if you are able to do it for leisure, I mean, I ride horses, and I feel immensely privileged that I have a good job that allows me to do that, and that I am not forced to sell my horse because of a lack of resources on my part, and that not everyone is as fortunate. So there are some people who may begin the sport or the leisure activity and find that their economic circumstances change a lot. We have immense unemployment, immense underemployment across sectors in this country right now. But there are, of course, people who are there because they like working with the horses. They're there because they like the sport. This is something they often say to me. They will foreground both the animals and the sport. So there's something about the sport and the challenge of partnering with an animal and getting the animal to do these incredible things for us that appeals to them. But they obviously have to have a different emotional approach to it. That said, there are examples. You know, Beth Underhill is a great Canadian show jumper, has been for many years. One of her most successful horses, Monopoly, she kept him until he died at age 33. So he got a stall in her barn, which she could have been renting out to a client to make more money or using for a horse that could make her more money. But out of respect for that horse and everything he'd done for her, she kept him until he died. He had the best spot in the barn. Mm-hmm. So there are these great patterns of commodification and privilege. But at the same time, we can't paint it all with the same brush, and we can see the diversity.
We talked a bit about, you know, loving the horses, and I mean, I don't deny that you or anyone else loves their horses and mm-hmm. treats them with the utmost care. But I guess I am slightly reminded of, for instance, when I'm at the Calgary Stampede, and a lot of the arguments that I get is, well, the horses just love to run. And I always argue, well, there's a difference between loving to run and being forced to run. We talked a bit about forced work before, but like, does loving a horse, taking good care of a horse, does it outweigh the potential risks, or how does one sort of bring that together?
It depends on the context. And that word love means so much in horse cultures. It's something I find very interesting, which is how it's used and by whom and to mean what. So people at auctions wanting to buy the next great racehorse will say, I fell in love with that horse.
Yeah.
Now, that's, of course, a very particular kind of love. It's not a deep love. It's not a true love. It's recognizing something about the potential. Probably. Maybe there's some kind of connection, right? A lot of our communication and our relationships with animals are nonverbal, and they're based on feeling, and they're based on emotion and intuition and our senses. But I think that's quite different than, I love this horse, I'm keeping this horse until he dies. So the stampede and these sorts of contexts are very different, and the people within them are going to vary, but there's very complex politics at play where, you know, there's a cemetery outside of Calgary for the bucking horses. So these horses are given names, they're moved around to do different rodeos, but they are given these gravestones at the end of their lives, marked gravestones, which undoubtedly costs money and which is a luxury not afforded to many horses. So how love is understood, what it means, is very complex and can't really be approached in a vacuum. It needs to be approached within its political economic context as one factor which is shaping and influencing people.
Mm-hmm. We're getting close to the end of our interview. I was just wondering if there's anything else you wanted to talk about, anything else you wanted to mention.
Well, I want to reiterate my appreciation for what you're doing, both as the act of, you know, creating the radio show, but also that, you know, you call it Animal Voices, and that you're grappling with the role of voice and the role of ideas, and doing so in a thoughtful way. Because I think sometimes animal politics can be approached in a deeply emotional, overly simplistic way on all sides. And I'm an emotional person as well, and deeply emotionally invested in animals, and so I understand that. But that we can harness our ideas and our feelings to try to do good. And, you know, the political theorist Antonio Gramsci argues that we're in a battle of ideas. And as a result, actually thoughtfully and carefully thinking through and talking through ideas and posing critical questions and interrogating alternatives and engaging in debate plays a really, really valuable role. And essential to any great movement anywhere on any topic has been not only individual choices or individual consumption. Those can play a role, and they have. But when we're talking about social, political, and economic issues, as we are, we have to be thinking about social, economic, and political solutions. So, you know, it's linking the personal and the political, but it's also recognizing that we do best when we unite, when we promote things like solidarity and ask the tough questions, but also when we commit ourselves to grappling with the negative and the positive. And so in many senses, what you're doing here is key. Of course, I'm going to talk about the book I'm working on, probably called Horse Tales, potentially Horse Tales, Animal Work Hierarchies, and Hope, because I think that ultimately this is all about hope.
Absolutely. That's wonderfully put, and I just want to thank you so much for coming chat with us today. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
That was Dr. Kendra Coulter of the Labor Studies Department at Brock University. Animal Voices is broadcast and produced at CFBU 103.7 FM in St. Catharines and CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. Thank you very much to Taylor Book for producing today's show and to our entire team. You can always contact us at animalvoices@gmail.com and find us on our Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr pages. You can also always listen to our archive of over 400 shows at animalvoices.ca. I'm Daniel Angernon. Thanks for listening.